Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you, and in this edition of the program, we'll have a look at the contents of Surah Al-Ankabut, or Chapter Spider, the 29th chapter of the Holy Quran. Brothers and sisters, we have reached the 9th verse of this Surah, Surah Ankabut, so let's listen to this verse, and we'll be right back with our discussion regarding it.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
والذين آمنوا وعملوا الصالحات لندخلنهم في الصالحين
And those who believe and do righteous deeds, we will surely admit them among the righteous into paradise.
So, as you listen to the verse, you might be familiar with some of the terminologies used in it because they have been repeated in the Holy Quran many times. وَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ لَنُدْخِلَنَّهُمْ فِي الصَّالِحِينَ And those who believe and do righteous deeds, certainly we shall admit them among the righteous. So, we stated and discussed this fact formerly about those who have faith and do righteous deeds. And this is repeated and emphasized again in this verse. So it says, and those who believe and do righteous deeds, we certainly shall admit them among the righteous. Now, one question that may be asked regarding this verse is, upon the purpose of the repetition of this meaning. Some commentators, regarding this meaning, I mean, believing and doing righteous deeds, have said that when this concept was mentioned in the former verses, it pointed to those who pave the path of the truth. But this verse, when it says, وَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ, it is pointing to those who are the guides of this path, and are as signs to the way of monotheism. Since the application of salihin, or righteous, is mentioned about many of the prophets, those who asked Allah to join them to the righteous ones. So, this is one probability. I mean, one of the reasons that commentary is mentioned. But other commentators have said that this is also probable, that in former verses, the words were about the forgiveness of sins and good rewards for this group of believers. But here, in the 9th verse, where it says, وَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ لَنُدْخِلَنَّهُمْ فِي الصَّالِحِينَ Their high rank is referred to, which is صالحين, the righteous ones, which itself is another reward for them. So, they will be set in the row of both the righteous and the divine prophets and truthful ones and the martyrs, and they will keep company with them. Dear listeners, let us have a break, and we'll be back with the rest of our conversation.
وَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ
صالحين So, as you were with us, we were discussing the concepts of Iman and Amal Salih, belief and doing righteous deeds. And we said that these concepts are always together when in the Holy Quran they are mentioned and brought up. But here, another thing has been mentioned. Because in the seventh verse, it was mentioned, وَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ لَنُكَفِّرَنَّ عَنْهُمْ سَيِّئَاتِهِمْ. We will certainly acquit them of their bad deeds. But here it says, لَنُدْخِلَنَّهُمْ فِي الصَّالِحِينَ. We will certainly admit them among the righteous. Some commentators in this regard, such as the author of Tafsir al-Mizan, Allama Tabatabai, says that the purpose of the believers mentioned in this verse regarding the previous verse means the children who, under the command of parents, are invited to polytheism, that if they persist for protection of their faith, they will become vagrant from their house and region, though being far from parents is difficult for them. On hereafter day, Allah will admit them among the righteous. So, actually what has been done in Tafsir al-Mizan is that this verse has been actually observed as a continuation of the previous sentence, where the Almighty Allah actually recommended the believers to be careful about their treatments with their parents and actually emphasized on this fact very much. So when the previous verse says that actually if do goodness to your parents, وَصَيْنَ الْإِنسَانَ بِوَالِدَيْهِ حُسْنًا, and we actually told man to do goodness unto his parents, but if they strive with you, وَإِن جَاهَدَاكَ لِتُشْرِكَ بِمَا لَيْسَ لَكَ بِهِ عِلْمٍ, that you associate with me somebody or something which you do not have the knowledge of, you are not to obey them. This means that this is a very hard and tough test and trial for the humankind to do. That's why another specific kind of reward for this act is mentioned. لَنُدْخِلَنَّهُمْ فِي الصَّالِحِينَ. For sure, we will definitely admit them among the righteous. With so many different forms of emphasis, this actually verse says that we will admit them among the righteous. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality, youth, Eastern Tales, Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. Narcotics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You're listening to Iran Radio from the heart of Tehran. We're grateful you stay tuned with us throughout the day. First, another compelling segment from our radio productions. We've put together a variety of engaging pieces for your listening enjoyment. Then, for a segment featuring profound scholarship, we bring you Ulema's speech. In this program, we broadcast excerpts from the Farsi and Arabic voices of well-known and reputable Islamic and Shia scholars and authorities with English translation, a unique opportunity to learn from the masters. To cap off this hour, it's time for Minbar. In this program, we present selected excerpts from the speeches of renowned Islamic scholars, covering a wide range of topics including ethics, theology, Quranic interpretation, Islamic history, and at times social and political issues. Such powerful messages from the scholars. Next up, it's time for another segment of radio productions. Stay with us.
Who could believe fish falling from the sky, or frogs for that matter? These events sound more like scenes from a science fiction movie than actual news. Even if we weren't living in an age of fake news, accepting such stories would still be difficult. Yet, some seemingly impossible phenomena are real. Rainfalls of fish and frogs do occasionally occur in certain parts of the world. The cause of this strange phenomenon is rare storms. Storms powerful enough to lift aquatic creatures from the sea into the sky and drop them back down over land. In 2018, the company Cambridge Analytica found itself at the center of a major scandal. The controversy dated back 2 years before the election, to a time when Facebook had managed to collect data from thousands of users. These data sets were part of users' private information, yet they were secretly handed over to Cambridge Analytica. The data even included details about users' friends. And the company ultimately gained access to information from over 50 million individuals.
We think that the only personal information they have about us is what we've given them. And we think we can exert some control over what we give them. And therefore, we think that our calculation, our trade-off here, is something that is somehow under our control, that we understand it.
Behavioral economics was an approach that extended its influence into other domains. If it could be used to change a president, then other tasks, like marketing and selling a product, were also possible. Marketers showed interest in this approach. They monitored people's behavior, analyzed it, and based on the results, took action to, for example, increase the sales of a product. This approach was a form of surveillance-based market, which transformed the way products were sold.
I can see how people with these characteristics typically behave over time, and that allows me to fit your data right into that arc and to predict what you're likely to do, not only now, but soon and later. This is what I call behavioral surplus, these data streams filled with these rich predictive data. Why surplus? Because right from the start, these were more data than was required to improve products and services.
Pepsi's Number Fever campaign in the Philippines has probably gone down in history as one of the biggest marketing disasters in history, mainly because of a human error that led Pepsi to print more winning caps than they planned. The resulting chaos caused riots, civil unrest, and even deaths.
The late years of the 20th century marked the era of monopolies, a time of ruthless competition among corporate giants to dominate consumer markets. These companies used every tactic imaginable to defeat their rivals. Marketing had turned into a battlefield, one that spanned the entire globe, from Latin America to Africa, and from there to East Asia, including the Philippines. The Philippines had been a colony of the United States for years, and even after gaining independence, little changed. Repeated interference in the country's politics and culture amounted to indirect colonialism, a solution that suited Western corporations well. Major companies like Coca-Cola and Pepsi saw opportunity. In the early 1990s, these two rivals turned the Philippines into a battleground. They did everything they could to bring each other down, although Coca-Cola was usually more successful. In 1992, Pepsi's marketers fired their last shot to defeat their competitor. They launched a promotional contest. Each bottle of Pepsi contained a number, and if someone found the winning number, they'd receive a cash prize. The campaign captured the attention of millions of poor Filipinos.
I won! Look for the winning number in Sari-Sari stores every day, off on TV, radio, newspapers. You could be a millionaire.
Pepsi sales skyrocketed, Coca-Cola stumbled, and the fever of the contest swept across the country. Pepsi became scarce. Some people bought dozens of bottles, not for daily consumption, but in hopes of winning. This continued until the moment of the draw, a tense moment that ended with the announcement of number 349. Everyone wanted to know who the winner was. Within minutes, it was revealed that a housewife had the winning number, but a strange problem arose. A bus driver also claimed to have the same number. Hours later, a tailor said he had it too. And it didn't stop there. The next day, thousands of people across the Philippines claimed they had number 349.
People were dancing in the streets, celebrating. They thought their problems were over. They were millionaires. It's still not certain exactly how many winners there were of lucky 349 bottle caps, but we know that Pepsi printed over 600,000 of them.
Pepsi quickly issued a statement. Company executives announced that the winning number had been printed not once, but thousands of times, meaning there would be no winner in the contest. People were furious. They had spent months investing time and money, and now, with a single statement, everything had been swept away. Those holding the winning number saw Pepsi's response as a major insult, one that demanded protest. What followed over the next few months resembled a crime drama. Protests outside Pepsi factories, clashes, political turmoil, official statements, and ultimately the decision by demonstrators to file lawsuit. The protesters accused Pepsi of colonial behavior, while Pepsi labeled them as agitators. Rumors spread that Pepsi executives had paid criminal groups to incite violence under the guise of protest. Several bombings, fatalities, and hundreds of arrests followed, all seemingly aimed at discrediting the protesters in the public eye. No one could believe that the security of an entire country and the lives of millions had been disrupted over a single mistaken number. Everyone knew Pepsi would never be held accountable for its actions. This was the nature of marketing campaigns: profit-driven, exploitative, and ultimately dismissive of reality. A century had passed since the invention of this profession, a profession that had infected the entire world with consumerism. The Pepsi incident was only the beginning.
Okay, look. So, it's the middle of the night. We're in the middle of absolutely nowhere, and look what we've got. See all this stuff? Look. Look. Hats, t-shirts, badges, posters, stickers, CD, torch. Now, all this stuff is clearly the promotional material for some multi-million dollar movie like Armageddon or Godzilla. Except, of course, it isn't. Because unlikely as it sounds, all this is actually the byproduct of a film that cost around $35,000 to make, that was shot by two Florida film school graduates who'd never made a feature before and didn't even expect this one to get released.
Marketing was no longer just a profession. It had become like a contagious disease, like a virus, widespread and deadly. This disease was infiltrating country after country, and now it was becoming more terrifying than ever. Even more frightening than the Blair Witch Project, a famous film from those years that was rumored to contain real footage discovered by the police. The footage told the chilling story of three documentary filmmakers. These three young people set out to make a documentary about a murderous witch, but strange things began to happen to them. The footage showed that they had disappeared in the Black Hills Forest. Viewers were left wondering, what happened to these three? The film was released just as the internet was becoming widespread. Websites constantly wrote about it, about the legend of the witch and the fate of the filmmakers.
The filmmakers also used the internet to draw the audience into their nightmare, publicizing the movie with a Blair Witch website, which treated the events depicted as real. They fortuitously sparked off a network of mirror sites, all of which got the world believing in the mythology of the Blair Witch. I mean, why bother with huge advertising budgets when word of mouth, as it's now referred to, can put you in touch with armies of fans convinced that the truth is out there?
Audiences would send this content to each other via email, and this very act led more people to go to the cinema.
BlairWitch.com.
Really, the website was kind of like a medium for the mythology, so we all created the mythology and threw it up there as kind of for people to find out about. Ed formatted the site in such a way to where it was a kind of interactive experience.
The film quickly grossed $250 million. Even though its budget was reportedly only $200,000, it was a major victory for artisan entertainment, though it seemed a bit strange. But the big question was the story real? Websites claimed yes, it was completely real, but gradually it became clear that both the film and its marketing were a massive lie, a lie worth $250 million.
I just wanted the website to just kind of be this investigative website that basically treated this case as if it were real. And I think that's what people dug it. And so, you know, it just became kind of a playground, really, for a lot of people that were interested in the movie, and it generated an incredible fan base.
Of course, Artisan had deliberately orchestrated this lie, a lie that today is known as viral marketing. It's a form of advertising that was invented in that very decade. operating much like the spread of a virus. All it took was the creation of compelling content. The rest was handled by the digital world and its users. People thought they were sharing entertaining texts or images with their friends. But in reality, they were spreading a marketing campaign. That content quickly infected the minds of millions. There was no direct advertising. It was only about cleverly crafted, seductive side stories.
So this is where the trail of the Blair Witch has led us so far. Where do we go from here? I have no idea, because I'm completely lost in the dark. The only advice I'd give you is believe nothing you hear or read. Because in the end, the Blair Witch Project is everything you'd hope for and nothing you'd expect. And that really is scary.
Once again, marketing had used a clever trick to pocket people's money. A trick made possible by the internet. For marketers, the internet was like the town square of the Middle Ages, a place to stir up commotion, a space that, in the modern era, was destined to become the central hub of marketing. The internet and smartphones transformed the path of advertising. These technologies were useful, but marketers preferred their darker side. To them, the internet cable was like a rope that bound the entire planet, creating something akin to a prison. A place where its inhabitants could be monitored and monetized. Critics called this phenomenon surveillance marketing.
And the question is, how can your brain be hacked? And the answer is, well, it doesn't get hacked with computer code, but it gets hacked with false information. And in fact, we've had false information since the time of the Romans. It's called propaganda. So what's the difference between marketing, which is what companies say they do, and propaganda? And the answer is the truth. That's the difference. When companies express a point of view that furthers their goals, then that point of view references true facts. That's called marketing. When a company expresses a point of view and tries to advance its goals based on misinformation, that's called propaganda. So the difference between marketing and propaganda is the truth. The corporations of America today have engaged in a very specific attempt to market their propaganda in order to get us to do different things than we might otherwise have done.
In this type of marketing, every behavior is a data point. Writing or searching for any word becomes content for analysis. Marketers, like prison guards, monitor every single action. They have a century of experience behind them and an ocean of information ahead. Our data is recorded and handed over to artificial intelligence. AI takes all the data and turns it into analysis, precise interpretations of our rational and irrational behaviors. Of course, irrational behaviors are a better raw material for marketers. The stranger our behavior online, the more diverse the data becomes. Diverse data leads to richer analyses, and these analyses form the foundation of prediction, predicting our needs, reactions, and thoughts. This information is highly valuable. The internet and surveillance marketing complement each other. It's a combination that creates the perfect opportunity for charlatans and the ideal space for selling products. Sometimes the product is an object. Sometimes it's an idea. Trump's election and that company's scandal were products of this era. An era of marketing abuse and exploitation of the human mind. Watching him raised another question. What will humanity's future look like under surveillance marketing? A future in which humans are the prey and marketers the hunters.
Of the prophet, and I walk on his blessed land. We must remember that life is short, and I need to focus on my deen and iman. When we do good deeds and follow the sunnah, you can ask for a helping hand, so you can share the load and share the deed with another in the name of Islam. And as I walk with my best foot forward,
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked in
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
Emmet is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. Please stay tuned. The potential for growth exists in all of existence. When we say Rabbul Alameen, meaning God nurtures existence, it is therefore clear that all of existence is capable of growth. It is not only humans who are capable of growth. Growth exists at various stages and levels throughout all of existence, meaning inanimate, objects, plants, animals, they are also capable of growth at their own level. Rabbul Alameen is nurturing all of existence. The believers at the beginning of their book, that is the Quran, say Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. And when they enter paradise, they will say, and the last of their call will be, praise to Allah, Lord of the worlds. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. To find out more about this program and our other programs, please log on to our website, iranradio.ir. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Maro hidayat.
تربیت میکنه.
It guides us through life.
همه چیز رو تعلیم داده.
It has taught us everything.
باید آموخت. باید فهمید.
We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
و اونگاه پیاده کردن این مفاهیم در واقعیت زندگی.
And try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من. این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
وَالَّذِي أَرْسَلَ رَسُولَهُ بِالْهُدَى وَدِينِ الْحَقِّ لِيُظْهِرَهُ عَلَى الدِّينِ كُلِّهِ وَلَوْ كَرِهَ الْمُشْرِكُونَ.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
منبر, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
The audience of IRB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Ja'far Ja'far.
I begin in the name of Allah, the most kind, the most merciful. It's due to that kindness and mercy that we have these opportunities where we gather in remembrance and glorification of Him, Tabaraka wa Ta'ala. Yesterday we discussed that one of the great challenges that our Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him and his family, faced came from the hands of the hypocrites, from the munafiqun. It is these hypocrites who lived amongst the Muslims. They claimed to be Muslim. They fulfilled many of the responsibilities of Muslims. And yet, even though they did all of these external things, Iman never entered their hearts. And because they never really accepted Islam, but they did these things just to be part of the wider Muslim Ummah and get the benefits from that, as we talked about, they constantly spread corruption within the land. They constantly spread fitna within the land, discord within the people, and chaos. And this is why we quoted this hadith that's reported of the Prophet yesterday, where we said, where the Prophet is reported to have said that, Inni akhafu alaykum kulla munafiq, that I fear for you the hypocrites within the community. Why? Because they are alim al-lisan, yaquluna ma ta'rifun. They are pleasant to hear, they are eloquent in speech, they say what you like to hear, wa yaf'aluna ma tunkirun. But they act in a manner that upsets you. You know, the existence of hypocrisy, as we talked about, did not begin with risala, nor did it end with the risala, with the end of the risala. But all the imams face some form of hypocrisy from the society and from the leaders. And you find that our eighth Imam alayhi salam's period in particular, The hypocrisy from the leadership and the caliph of that time was in a very profound state, in a very heightened state. You know, you look at the history of the caliphs that came, especially after Karbala, majority of them did not hide their animosity for the Ahlul Bayt. They tolerated them, yeah, they kept them close to them, but at the same time, they did not hide the fact that they had bughd and rancor in their hearts for the family of the Prophet. But Ma'mun took a different approach. Yeah? Ma'mun was one of the few caliphs who actually changed his tone and presented himself as a lover of the Ahlul Bayt. Right? He presented himself as one who cared about the Prophet's family. And this is why he offered his throne, he offered his leadership, whatever he had to the Imam alayhi salam. But the subtext was understood as well, that he was doing these things to carry favor with the people. He wanted the people who were upset at his father killing Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam to not turn against him. And so he presented this external demeanor of faith, external demeanor of love for the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, so that he could keep the Imam under text. And this is the definition of hypocrisy, right? Where one externally presents themselves in a manner that is internally not how they actually are. And of course, our 8th Imam alayhi salam knew this. It wasn't that it was hidden from the 8th Imam, but part of the responsibility of the A'imma alayhim salam was to deal with the nifaq of the munafiqun, right? Of the hypocrisy of the hypocrites. Let's find this very beautiful hadith in the book Uyun Akhbar al-Ridha, where our 8th Imam al-Ridha alayhi afdalu salatu wassalam, Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad, he describes the role of an Imam. And this is, in a way, it's nice to hear what he describes the Imams with, but then there's a part that we have to pay attention to. He says, Al-Imamu, or he's reported to have said, Al-Imamu aminullah fi ardi, that Imams are the trustees of Allah upon this earth. وَحُجَّتَهُ عَلَىٰ ibadi, and his proof upon the servants of Allah. وَخَلِيفَتَهُ fi biladi, and he is the representative of the vicegerent in his cities. الدَّاعِي إِلَى اللَّهِ وَالذَّعْبُ عَنْ حُرَمِ اللَّهِ, that they are the callers to Allah and the defenders of the sanctity of Allah. These are the positions or the role that an imam carries. Al-imamu al-mutahhiru min al-dhunub, he is pure from any type of sins. Al-mubarra'u min al-uyub, and he is free from any type of deficiencies. Al-makhsusu bil-ilm mawsumun bil-hilm, and that they are filled with knowledge and they are overflowing with forbearance. Nidhamuddin wa izzul muslimin, and they are the ones who bring order to religion and the stronghold of believers. But then he says something really beautiful, and they are ghaydhul munafiqin, they are the ones who are the cause of a hatred in the hypocrites. This is the role of the imams. You know hypocrites need someone to hate. Yeah, because if there was no one to have their animosity towards, there would be no hypocrisy. And here we find that the imams were that fuel for the hypocrites. Yeah, that they were the ones who brought that extra flame or that extra fire into the hearts of hypocrites. And this is something that hypocrisy is never empty of, this dislike for the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, this dislike for the family of the Prophet. There's this really beautiful hadith where our first Imam Ali alayhi afdalu salatu was salam, Amma salli ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad, where he's reported to have said that if I were to strike a believer on the nose for that believer to hate me, that believer would never hate me. But if I were to give everything in this world to a munafiq for them to love me, that munafiq would never love me. Yeah? Why? Because he said, I heard the Prophet say, Ya Ali, la yuhibbuka illa mu'min, wa la yubghiduka illa munafiq. Yeah? That Ya Ali, that only a believer will love you, and only a hypocrite will dislike you. So it's this concept of hypocrisy that we began yesterday. and that I want to take going forward, inshallah. As we said, this will be a series that will last maybe 6 or 7 lectures. We're still working on it. But we're going to try to cover the following things in the series to give us a robust understanding. Inshallah, in the next coming lectures, we're going to look at the definition of hypocrisy from a linguistic and a religious context. And we will also look at God's warnings of hypocrisy. Like, what does Allah Azza wa Jal say, and how does He describe the munafiqun? Then we will also look at the different forms of hypocrisy. There are 3 types, or 2 main types of hypocrisy. The second has 2 branches, but we will look at each one in detail. And in particular, not only are we going to look at it from the Quranic and the Hadith literature, but we're going to try to see how that applies to us in our world today. That do we see these forms of hypocrisy in our world, or do we not? Or is this something that we just have to be cautious about? We will try to understand that. Then we will also look at the signs and the attributes of those who are considered hypocrites in the eyes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And then how to cure hypocrisy in case we find that when I look at my heart, I have some traces of hypocrisy. How do I cure that? And then some other signs or other quote-unquote suggestions that we find in our literature of how to safeguard ourselves when we are around people who are hypocrites. So you can tell the discussion is quite extensive on this subject, and we're trying to make sure that we don't leave any holes in it so that we have more questions later. And so we'll try to make something robust out of it.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen.
It's too late. If you haven't spoken up yet, it might be too late for you. This is your call to say something and not let history judge you for what you should have done.
There once was a day when we were shadows in the street, paper thin excuses crumbling at our feet. Screens glowed brightly, selling fear and doubt. The truth bled quietly, seldom spoken out. But today it's on the news again that the Zionist entity has murdered Palestinians and burned their city. Savagery is in their blood, genocide their game. The world is watching live as they enter the hall of shame. Don't they see nations waking up? Don't they see people rising up? Don't they see that we won't bow? It's too late to stop us now. It's too late to stop us now. It's too late. Can't you see the land is breaking? It's too late. Can't you see the children dying? It's too late. Let's not be judged by history. Should have done to save humanity. It's too late. Oh, it's too late. Oh, it's too late. America gives the go-ahead, then it sends in bombs. Israel calls it self-defense and murders without qualms.
Since when has killing children become a source of pride? Silence must be broken if you want to turn the tide. It's time we made the right choice, our lives may be on the line. It's time we raised our voice, chanting free, free Palestine. The police can do what they want to do, detain one or two. But thousands of millions are coming through, a move they cannot undo. Don't they see nations waking up? Don't they see people rising up? Don't they see that we won't bow? It's too late to stop us now. It's too late to stop us now. It's too late. Can't you see the land is breaking? It's too late. Can't you see the children dying? It's too late. Let's not be judged by history for what we should have done to save humanity. It's too late. Oh, it's too late. Oh, it's too late. Oh, it's too
Greetings, dear listeners. I'm welcoming you to another meaningful hour here on Iran Radio. First, let's embark on another global journey with Round the World with Reporters. Our correspondents will bring you more fascinating reports on a variety of subjects from their regions. Diverse stories from across the globe. Following that, we bring you The Keys of Life, hosted by Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musavi. This program aims to introduce the Islamic lifestyle based on the book Mafatihul Hayat, written by Ayatollah Javadi Amuli, Practical Guidance for a Purposeful Life. After The Keys of Life, we delve into viewpoints. Here, Brother Atta and Sayyid Ali Marashi will lead an analytical roundtable discussion of various religious, political, cultural, and social issues of the Islamic world today. In this program, we pay particular attention to mainstream news of the Islamic issues in Muslim lands. Coming up, it's time for more Round the World with Reporters. Don't go anywhere.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the World with Reporters.
Britain's far right on the march again in their biggest show of strength yet, led by a man who made his name scapegoating migrants and Muslims and spreading conspiracy theories. Simultaneously, a counter-demonstration organized by rights groups and unions against what they call racism and the rise of fascism.
Everyone should have free speech, but there's a defined line between free speech and hate speech, and some of the things he says is hate speech. So we have the freedom of speech to speak up and speak out about what's right and what's wrong.
I think it's a very cheap shot to put.